Well, tonight is the Super Bowl. Denver Broncos and the Carolina Panthers are going to compete in Super Bowl 50 for the honor of being the world champions. And for the past 2 weeks, since winning their individual conference championships, both teams have been working hard on a game plan and studying films of previous games in order to be victorious tonight. A lot is at stake, other than just bragging rights. For the Denver Broncos, this could be the last game for arguably one of the best quarterbacks to have ever played the game, Peyton Manning. He has not yet announced his retirement, but sports pundits are betting that after this game, he will. And he certainly has had a long, illustrious career, and I think he would love to exit the game with a win on the biggest stage. On the other side are the Carolina Panthers, who have never been to a Super Bowl. Behind their electrifying showman quarterback, Cam Newton, they too are looking to show the world that they belong in the biggest game of the year. And they would love nothing more than a big win tonight to silence their critics and bring a championship back to Charlotte, North Carolina. Now I'm going to go out on a limb this morning and make a prediction concerning the game tonight. And this is what I predict. I predict that one team is going to win, the other's going to lose. That's bold, isn't it? One's going to taste the thrill of victory, the other's going to taste the agony of defeat. For one team, the evening's going to go as planned. For the other, at a critical junction, their game will fall apart. Perhaps a turnover, a missed field goal, a drop pass, which will cost them the win. On one sideline, there will be jubilation and celebration, but on the other, the players will have their heads down at the end of the game with towels over their faces to hide their sorrow. Now, you and I love it when our plans come together, when life works out as we envisioned it would. We celebrate our successes, our victories, the good times. But we also know that in the back of our minds that at any moment our plans could change. In a split second, our lives could be forever changed. Someone close to us might die, leaving a giant hole in our hearts and majorly disrupting our plans. If you've been following the stock market recently, you know that we're an up and down roller coaster season right now. And some economists are claiming that we are headed for a great financial depression. We are over $19 trillion in debt. That's a staggering amount. Every man, woman, and child in the United States owes over $56,000. I don't know about you, but I don't have that money. That's a lot of money. And big companies have recently announced major layoffs. I suspect that many working for them never saw it coming. It was not in their 5 or 10 year plan to be laid off. Valentine's Day is next Sunday. Love is in the air. Many young couples are going to get engaged and some will be married on that day. And every couple for which I have performed the marriage ceremony, every couple believed that their marriage would go the distance, that they would be true to each other until death do them part. None of them that I know of entered marriage thinking that in 10 or 20 years they would break up and divorce. But you know, divorce happens. And lives are shattered. Life doesn't work out as planned, as envisioned. Besides all these things, then we have sickness, can strike at any moment. None of us have total immunity. All of us are susceptible to the viruses and life-threatening illnesses that are going around. Now there's a new one out there that everybody's talking about. They're not exactly sure how you get it. You know, we have all these things. We don't know what's going to hit us, when the bottom might drop out, but one thing is about the future is certain, and that is, it's tentative. All of our plans are tentative, subject to change without notice. Now, Jesus' disciples had great plans for Jesus. And it appeared that the plans for Jesus were coming together through a series of claims that Jesus has made concerning himself and through the miracles that he had performed. Jesus has been progressively showing his true identity as the Son of God, as the Messiah, the Promised One. And it all seemed to come together on that Sunday when Jesus enters into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. It had been revealed to Daniel hundreds of years earlier that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks the streets shall be built again and the walls even in troublesome times. The command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, we know, was issued by Artaxerxes Longimanus to Nehemiah on March the 5th, 444 B.C. It took 49 years or 7 weeks of years for the temple to be fully restored and the infrastructure of Jerusalem to be rebuilt. And from the completion of the rebuilding of Jerusalem until the time that the Messiah, the Prince, would present himself to Israel was 434 years or 62 weeks of years. And the Jews in those days followed a lunar calendar, 30 days in a month, or 12 months in a year. Some years had 13 months to kind of make it up. Thus, a prophetic year equals 360 days, converting it into the Gregorian calendar, which we use. Jesus presented himself to the nation as the Messiah, the Prince, on March the 30th, 33 A.D. That was the day of Palm Sunday, the first Palm Sunday, when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. Now, why on the back of a donkey? Because it fulfills a prophecy. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9 says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughters of Zion, shout, O daughters of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lovely and riding on a donkey. A colt, the foal of a donkey." This would be the sign. This is how they would know that Jesus was the Messiah, the one that had been promised. He came on the exact date that he entered into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. He presented himself as the Messiah. On that day, the whole multitude of disciples, Jews, who, by God's grace, had accepted Christ as their Messiah, as Jesus descended from the Mount of Olives, they began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory to the highest." But like so many, they thought that their Messiah would be the conquering King, that he would somehow come in and he would establish his kingdom, he would deliver them from Rome and restore the sovereignty and glory of Israel, and that he would rule over the entire world. The disciples were sure that Jesus was about to establish his kingdom here upon the earth, and that Peter had earlier asked Jesus, "See, we have left all and followed you, therefore what shall we have? What is in it for us?" You know, we've left our businesses. We've come to follow you. To which Jesus replied, "Assuredly, I say to you that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on thrones of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." And so the disciples thought, wow, this is going to happen. And they had these visions of grandeur. They saw themselves sitting there on the thrones beside Jesus in the kingdom, judging the nation. And they were, this is really going to be great. And so as they were on their way to the upper room and the end of time, of Jesus' time on earth, they were arguing among themselves as to who is the greatest in the kingdom. Who's going to occupy number two slot right beside Jesus? But you know, at the supper table, as they're gathered there in the upper room, Jesus, and as they're laying out around enjoying this last supper, Jesus rattles them with a few statements. Notice what Jesus says, beginning of verse 21 of John chapter 13. Jesus says, it would help if I get to John, in 1 Corinthians, John chapter 13, verse 21. It says, when Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, most assuredly I say to you, one of you will betray me. One of you is going to betray me. You're going to stab me in the back. You're going to sell me out. You're going to hand me over to the authorities. One of you is going to betray my trust. Now notice the reaction of the disciples. It says in verse 22, they looked at one another perplexed about whom he spoke. They didn't understand. Betrayal? What does this mean? So they asked Peter, and Peter asked John, who was the disciple whom Jesus loved, to ask Jesus, who? Who is going to betray you? And look at Jesus' response. Verse 26. It is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Then Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. Now the disciples are kind of in shock here. This wasn't part of their plan. They were a loyal bunch of guys who had been on missionary trips together. They had experienced close, intimate fellowship with Jesus Christ for 3 years. They had lived with him, ate with him, followed him wherever he went. Even Judas had gone out on mission trips. He had given out tracts on the Sea of Galilee, on the shores. He was there and he talked to people about Jesus as the Messiah. And even after Christ identifies Judas as being the one who would betray him, the rest of the disciples were baffled by all of this. They just couldn't believe it, that this was happening. On this back of this first statement that rattles them, Jesus issues a second one. John chapter 13, verse 31, he says, and so when he had gone out, that is Judas, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and glorify him immediately. Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me, and I, as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. So now I say to you, where I am going, you can't come. What do you mean? Where I'm going, you can't come. Now, Jesus had earlier spoken to the disciples about the Son of Man being glorified. In fact, he said, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Most assuredly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. Jesus' glorification would come through his death. And he talked to his disciples about being lifted up, and when he lifts up, he's going to draw all men to himself. He had intimated before that for some time that his time here on earth is drawing to a close. He's going to die. He's going to leave them. But that wasn't according to their plan. What do you mean, Lord, you're going away? You're abandoning us. We have given up everything to follow you. We have given up our fishing business. Matthew left his lucrative tax collecting business behind, and now it appears that Jesus is abandoning them. Now Peter takes the lead, and he asks a question that was on everybody's mind, verse 36. He says, Simon Peter said, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answered him, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterwards. But you know, Peter doesn't drop it there. He says, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. Jesus answered him, will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times. Now, Peter said he's willing to die. He's willing to lay down his life. But Jesus reveals here, you're going to deny me three times. Luke reveals that the Lord had said to Peter prior to this, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, but when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Peter, you are going to be tested. Satan is going to take, you're going to come under a satanic attack. You are going to be sifted. You're going to fall. You're going to fall big time. You're going to deny me not once, not twice, but three times in a space of a few hours. And at the moment of my greatest need, at the time of my greatest need, you're going to fail me. You are not going to go to prison with me. You're not going to die with me. You are going to run and hide. You know, not just Peter, but all of them would desert him. Whereas they were leaving the upper room on their way to the Mount of Olives, Jesus said to all of them, all of you will stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. All of them are going to deny and desert Jesus. And talk about knocking the wind out of one's sail. Talk about the world coming crashing down around them, their dreams, their hopes. Peter, how could he? I mean, if you took a public opinion survey among the 5,000 as to who will sit next to Christ in his kingdom, the vote probably would have been split three ways. Peter, James, and John, with Peter getting the nod. After all, it was Peter who made the great confession, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, and it was to Peter that Jesus said, you are Peter, and on this rock I'm going to build my church. Peter, you're upon the rock of your confession. I'm going to build my church. And if asked who would be least likely to defect, I'm sure that Peter would have won hands down. Oh, he had his faults. He usually spoke before his mind was engaged. Occasionally he did that. He was the bold talker. But only Peter walked on water. Certainly he would be the last to deny Jesus. Other events in that upper room that evening had added to the emotional turmoil that these disciples were feeling. They perhaps felt ashamed by their prideful refusal to wash each other's feet, which prompted Jesus to do what they had refused to do. Perhaps they sensed that the Lord himself was troubled in spirit when he revealed that Judas would be the traitor. They sensed that their settled world was about to be turned upside down. It's crashing around them, their dreams. There's a dark foreboding hung that over that evening gathering. They may have been thinking, is there anything certain about this uncertain future? Is there any hope for us? One of us is going to betray the Lord. The Lord is leaving us. He's going someplace we can't follow. And Peter, our brightest star, the rock, is going to deny the Lord. Jesus has talked about his death as if this was the end of the road for them, and what's going to happen? The end of the day. With what are they left? It's revealed in verse 1 of chapter 14. Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. What they were left with was a troubled heart. A troubled heart. The word trouble here is a translation of the form of the verb, which means to shake or to stir up. It's used in Scripture figuratively of severe mental or spiritual agitation. It's a combination of a lot of negative emotions. There's anxiety, perplexity, confusion, fear that's all combined together to produce a troubled heart. They're scared, they're paralyzed, they're afraid to face the future. And when Jesus says to them, let not your heart be troubled, he is not saying to them, don't start being troubled, but rather stop it. Stop being troubled. For they were in the midst of a complete meltdown. I don't know if you've ever been there before in your life. When it seems like all of your world is coming crashing in and everything is going haywire. It's not what you have planned. It's not what you have envisioned. Things have happened. And you're filled with anxiety, with fear, with perplexity. You're wondering what's going on. And your world is shattered. Now what can calm them and what calms us? Comes down to a simple matter of trust. Jesus says here, you believe in God, believe also in me. Trust me. Trust me. Just as his disciples believed, they were to trust him. Jesus is thus putting himself on an equal par with God. The Father is the appropriate object of faith. He says, trust me, put your hope in me. We can put our hope, our uncertain future, the fears of an uncertain future into the hands of a known God. A certain God. We can trust him. David understood this. He understood what it was like to be in dire situations, to have one's world coming crashing around him. He knew what it was like to live in fear. He was a marked man. People were out to get him. People were seeking his life. But he also knew the secret of how to be calm from a troubled heart. He writes in Psalm 56, verse 3, whenever I'm afraid, I will trust in you. In God, I will praise his word. In God, I will put my trust. I will not fear what man can do to me. Trusting God. Trusting Jesus Christ. Jesus is not calling upon them though to trust them initially for salvation because they're already saved. They've already did that. In John chapter 13 verse 10, he has deemed them clean. But the present tense of the verb believe refers instead to ongoing trust in him. Continually trusting in him. Living faith. Living faith. Now Jesus is going to reveal three certain truths concerning the future that you and I can bank on. We can take these things to the bank. Three truths which will give us hope and comfort when it appears that our life is falling apart around us. Three certainties that are going to sustain us through uncertain times. Now due to time constraint, I'm only going to share with you the first. Next week, Lord willing, the other two. So what is certain about our uncertain future? Or what is certain about our uncertain future? Notice what Jesus says, verse 2. He says, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. Jesus Christ says that if heaven is not a reality, I would have told you. I'm not going to lead you astray. I'm not going to string you along. I'm not making this up. Heaven is real. Heaven is real. You can bank on it. There is a Father's house, and in my Father's house are many mansions. Now, Jesus Christ describes heaven here as my Father's house. Most of us probably have in our minds, perhaps an 18-bedroom cottage, are one of those homes in Voorhees Township or Cherry Hill Township that you've been drooling over. You're thinking to yourself, I may be living in a three-bedroom split level right now, but when I get to heaven, I'm going to have a mansion over the hilltop, and I just can't wait to move in. There's going to be a big swimming pool in my backyard adjacent to a golf course. I'm even going to have a bowling alley in my basement. That's got to be heaven. Now, I hate to be bearers of bad news, but such ideas of heaven are more fanciful than fact. Nothing is said in the Bible about swimming pools, golf courses, or bowling alleys in heaven. But what do we know about the Father's house? You know, this is not the first time Jesus used this term, Father's house. In John chapter 2, verse 16, when he made the scourge of small cords and drove out the rip-off artists, he said, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. The Father's house refers to, in this sense, referred to the earthly temple there in Jerusalem. It was the house of worship. Now, I don't believe Jesus has in mind here that Herod's temple, for he's not speaking about an earthly temple, but a heavenly one of which the writer of Hebrews says that the earthly one is a pattern of the spiritual one in heaven. Heaven is not some spacious country club lined with expensive homes. Heaven is not a Disneyland resort. But heaven is a celestial temple where God is worshipped. A temple where God is worshipped. You know, we do have glimpses of what heaven's like. John, while he was exiled on the island of Patmos, was given a glimpse of what heaven is like. The scene is quite different than what many people imagine and envision. He writes in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, he says, after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number of all the nations, tribes, people, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And when John asked for identification as to the numberless group of people, it was revealed that these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve Him day and night in the temple, and He who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them nor the heat, for the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. This is heaven. This is what heaven is going to be like. It's going to be one large continual worship service in the presence of God in His heavenly temple. The departed saints surrounding the throne of God, singing praises to Him, exalting and worshiping Him. Our pleasure throughout eternity is going to be to worship God in His presence. But you say, well, but doesn't the text say that my Father's house, there are many mansions? Well, yes, it does. However, that's an unfortunate translation of the ancient text, the Greek text, for the word mansion literally means abode or abiding place. Same verse word is used in verse 23 of the text, 14, where it says, if anyone loves me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. That's the same word, our home with him. In classical Greek, the word described rest areas that the Romans built along their great highways. We have rest stops, you know, where you can pull in and get gas and something to eat. Well, they had rest areas, not just stop your chariot and put some gas in it, I guess, or gas in your horse or whatever. But yeah, they had a place to sleep. These were the rooms. Sort of like the first century Days Inn or Holiday Inn. So what Jesus is saying, that heaven as it exists right now, is a huge temple in which God dwells and from which He rules. A huge temple which has many rooms for the weary pilgrims to rest. It's similar to the shadowy earthly temple of Herod, which had side rooms that were built for weary pilgrims to stay while in Jerusalem to worship. But unlike Herod's temple, the Father's house will have room for all. It will have room for all. And Jesus will make sure of that because he's going there to prepare a place. That's heaven now. But you know, one day at the end of time, the beginning of eternity, this celestial temple that's in heaven right now, the place where you and I will live one day, is going to descend from heaven to earth. At least suspended between heaven, the new heavens and new earth. John was privy to this revelation. For he says in Revelation 21 verse 1, "Now I saw a new heavens and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." The city comes down, the temple comes down, the New Jerusalem descends from heaven. And he goes on to say, "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." This celestial temple, the tabernacle of God, will one day descend in the form of the New Jerusalem, our eternal home, the eternal city. It's going to be suspended between the new heavens and new earth. And John in Revelation 21 describes the beauty of this place, the magnificent celestial city in which we're going to dwell. It's going to be constructed of multicolored precious gems with gates of pearls. It's going to radiate the glory of God. In fact, the city has no need of the sun or the moon or to shine in it, for the glory of God illumines it. The Lamb is its light. In fact, according to Revelation 21:21, the streets of the city are pure gold, like transparent glass. What a place! What an incredible city! It far exceeds the imagination of man. But it's not just the beauty, but also its size. You know, some people might worry that heaven, that the city's not going to be large enough to house everybody. That perhaps our heavenly home will be like a crowded apartment complex and we will be tripping over each other. But such worries quickly dispel when we carefully consider the dimensions that are given to the city. Revelation 21 verse 16, "The city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth, and he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal." 12,000 by 12,000 by 12,000. Now notice that the text says that the measured 12,000 furlongs, so there are different sizes of furlongs. So scholars are debating about it. I've taken one, I've kind of averaged them out, different size. 12,000 furlongs would be equal to 1,500 miles. The base of it would stretch from the tip of Maine to the tip of Florida, from the Atlantic Ocean to the state of Colorado. Square. That's big. I did some further calculations. You know, the city's also that far high, too. It's a cube. The height's the same. And suppose that the city is constructed similar to one of our high-rise apartments or office buildings. And suppose we figured 15 feet for each story. There would be 528,000 stories. Every one of the stories would contain 2.25 million square miles. All the stories combined would total 1 trillion 188 billion square miles. I can't wrap my mind around that. I don't know about you. Now, the Department of Eugenics of the Carnegie Institute has estimated that the total population of the world since Adam to today is approximately 30 billion people. So 30 billion people have lived. And if you take the estimate of the population and you divide it by, you divide the total number of square miles by the total people that have ever lived, every one of us would have approximately 40 square miles. 40 square miles. That'd be like living in Montana. You don't know your neighbors, you know. The closest neighbor's 40 miles away. I don't think that's how heaven's going to be like, because we're going to all be together. But I tell you, this place is big. Jesus is not, he's telling us the truth when he says, in my Father's house are many mansions. This place is huge. There is place for everyone, and when you figure into the equation that there are a large number of the world's population are not going to be spending eternity in heaven, I don't think you and I are going to be cramped. This is our home. This is our home sweet home that's awaiting us. And Jesus says we can count on it. He says, if it were not so, I would have told you. This is my Father's house. I am going there to prepare a place for you. It is just as real as Berlin, New Jersey. It is not some pipe dream. It's not some harebrained utopia thought up by some philosopher. It is the abode of God. Jesus says, trust me on this. It is a certain fact. You can bank on it. It can be a certain part of our future. For Jesus has gone to prepare a place, a room for you and I in heaven. But may I say to you, it can and must be a part of our present thinking as well. For it's not just pie in the sky by and by, but this certain truth is for the gritty, fearful, shaky now and now. You know, some people say, oh, you pastor, you are so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. I would dare say most of us are more earthly minded than we're no heavenly good. That our minds need to be and our thinking needs to be upon the home that's ahead of us. And on certain times. You know, that thought of an eternal home is what kept men and women of faith in the past going when it got tough. When life was uncertain, it's what kept them from becoming too attached to this present world. I think of Abraham. God had given Abraham a glimpse of his eternal home, and while here on earth he had no permanent address, by faith he left behind the permanent family dwelling in Ur of the Chaldees to go on a lifelong camping expedition. To travel to the land that God would eventually give to his descendants. The only piece of real estate that Abraham ever owned was the burial plot at the Oak of Mamre. That's it. But Hebrews 11 verse 9 says that by faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. There was no permanent address. He wandered around the land of Palestine in his camel camper. Didn't complain about not having a permanent home. The reason was he was content. He was content to be a sojourner and a camper in this life because he waited for the city. He waited for the city which has foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Through the eyes of faith, he saw his permanent residence. It wasn't here on this earth, but a city that had strong, sure foundation built by God himself in which one day he would dwell. And as a result, he entrusted his life to God. But not just Abraham, but all the members that are part of the hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. People of faith. They look forward to something far better than what we have here on this earth. Hebrews 11:13 says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they call to mind the country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He's prepared a city for them." My friends, people of faith, we look forward. We look forward to a heavenly city, and as a result, we don't become too attached to the things down here. Everything that we have right now, we're going to leave behind one day. We know that we're just merely passing through this world. We are sojourners. We are pilgrims. We are legal aliens. Our citizenship is in heaven. God has prepared a city for us. The heavenly perspective is what keeps us going when it gets tough down here, because we're not too attached to this world. We're looking forward to our heavenly home. But it's also what encourages us to trust God in the tough, uncertain times in which we live. Paul certainly faced hardship and setbacks and problems in serving God. And yet he writes in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16, "Therefore we do not lose heart." We don't become discouraged. We don't give up. We don't walk away, and we don't call it quits when it gets going tough. Life appears to be crumbling. Still, Paul says that he has cultivated a heavenly perspective on life. He writes, "For our light afflictions, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we do not look up the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." See, Paul could fix his eyes on what's not seen. He looked beyond what was going on around him, and he had his eyes on Jesus. He had his eyes on the final destination, his eternal home, the glories of heaven. He didn't lose heart, because something better awaited him. He didn't give up. Now, my friends, Jesus Christ is preparing a place for you and I. He's preparing my 40 square miles. See, the world is not my home. It's not your home. We are indeed just passing through. Our citizenship is in heaven. That's our final destination. We're pilgrims and strangers here, and by faith, we believe. We believe, we continue to trust Jesus. When it appears that our world is falling around us, our dreams are being crushed, our plans are unraveling, we trust His Word that there's something better awaiting for us. We don't need to be fearful. We don't need to be troubled. For we know that what we are facing is only temporary. But we have something eternal waiting for us. Jesus says to you and I, "Trust me. Trust me. Trust your uncertain future to me. Heaven is real. Heaven is real." What a blessed thought, isn't it? When things go bad down here, we know this is just temporary. God has a much better place awaiting us.